Hey, everybody, real quick, Mike Underwood and I have decided to make things a little fun for the Worldcon fundraiser. Basically, at the moment I'm recording this little bit, we have got $150 left. That's it. And then we're done. So what Mike and I thought would be cute was if this finishes out by Monday, he and I will record our silly Yoda Kermit thing live, and we will talk as Yoda and Kermit throughout the entire session. Even as we're reading, I think he's reading the Candide? I can't remember how you pronounce that. And I am reading Nisha, Thus Spake Zarathustra. So, yeah, we will do that live. So if you want to donate, it's easy to do. Just go to skiffyfanny.com, go to the right-hand sidebar. You'll see the little GoFundMe thingy there. Just click, donate $5, whatever you want. There's $150 left, so it's easy to get to by Monday. So on that note, I'm going to shut up and let you guys get to the episode. Enjoy.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show. I'm Sean.
I'm Julia.
We have two special guests today. We have Cecilia Tan and Marianne Mohanraj.
Thank you for having us.
It's great to be here.
Awesome. So why don't we start with you, Cecilia, because you are the fine person at Circlet.
And as my business card says,
fine person.
Publisher, editor, janitor. Yes, because who do you think it is that changes the litter box in my home office? Of course it's me.
So for those that don't know Circlet, tell us a little bit about just kind of the general mission, I guess.
The mission of Circlet Press began 22 years ago to publish erotic science fiction and fantasy, which at the time nobody was doing. The science fiction publishers wouldn't touch anything that had sexuality, basically, unless it was extremely, extremely hidden in it, including gay and lesbian content, erotic content, anything. And of course, the erotica publishers, which were mostly just pornography publishers at that time, were basically like, you know, what, science fiction? That's that weird stuff with aliens and, you know, whatnot. You mean like alien, like anal probes or what? You know,
oh, God.
Exactly. At that time, the...
I mean, maybe sometimes.
Yeah.
I think I did write a story.
No. I like probes.
Yes.
That's not all it is?
It's basically, you know, I mean, that was back when, you know, Anne Rice's vampires were the thing, and it's explicitly stated that, well, her vampires don't have sex. Like, they don't have the ability to have sex. It's all just magical yearning, you know. And I was like, you know, I think maybe there are some people out there besides me who might enjoy mixing their chocolate and peanut butter, you know, together, and I had written a story that called Telepaths Don't Need Safe Words.
An awesome story.
That, you know, I couldn't even send it to be rejected anywhere. Like, it was already counted out by every form of writer's guidelines, you know, that there were. So I was like, all right, I guess I have to self-publish it. Started Circlet Press that way, and basically as soon as I published it, people were like, oh, it's obvious why you had to self-publish this. So I didn't have that sort of stigma that all the self-publishers did at the time, and immediately began getting manuscripts in the mail from, you know, CIFWA members who were like, oh, I have stories like that at home in a drawer that I can't publish anywhere. Will you publish them? And I'd be happy to publish your manuscript. Please send it to this P.O. box, you know. And we were off and running, basically. So, yeah. I was working in book publishing already at the time, so it wasn't like, oh, no, how do I start a publishing house? I already, you know, was well-equipped to be the person doing it. So, yes, yeah, so that's how it got going. And we quickly moved into, like, themed anthologies. And I think our fourth or fifth anthology, I said, let's do one called Sex Magic. And, you know, put out a call for submissions to see what we get, and I got a story from you.
I think that might be in Sex Magic 2.
Actually, maybe in Sex Magic 2, which was, like, number 6 or 7. Like, it was the next thing. Actually, maybe I read for them at the same time, and then we ended up splitting them. I can't remember exactly now. This is so long ago. but I can't remember. So, but yes, and Marianne's...
When did the press officially start?
So we officially started in 1992.
Okay.
Wow. I think you published that story of mine maybe around 93, 94.
Yeah, something like that.
It was the first story I published anywhere.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess one of the questions I have is... like 1992 is, it doesn't seem like it's that long ago, but in publishing terms, it really is.
And it actually is a long time ago. I mean, that's 22 years ago.
It's so long ago that the genre of paranormal romance did not exist yet.
And ebooks certainly did not exist.
Yes. And there was nothing like ebooks.
Well, the web just started in 95, right? So
right.
Mm-hmm. It's pre-web.
Yeah, wow, pre-World Wide Web, yeah.
So I guess another question I have is, besides like the really obvious stuff, like now we have e-books and e-readers and there's that market, how has the business, either in your particular case, Circlet Press, how has it evolved and changed in the last 20-something years?
Well, the interesting thing is that when we started, of course, it was sort of underground thing. You know, that first 100 copies of Telepaths, I literally bought a big stapler and stapled the copies together myself, like sitting on the floor of my apartment.
That's awesome.
And yeah, I stole the photocopying from my day job in publishing to do the pages, you know, because who knew who was going to buy this crazy little erotic book that I had done for myself? And you know, I brought it to LunaCon, sold every copy I had. People were chasing me down the hallway like, do you have any more of that book? I've heard about this book. And I'm like, I'll make more. But then I went to professional printing after that because I was like, yeah, I'm not going to staple 500 copies of the next run.
Yeah, it turns out that's a lot of work.
As well as staples, actually. And there is an economy of scale. The more you're printing, it becomes cheaper to just have an actual professional printer do it. So, yeah. And, you know, this was before barcodes. This was before a lot of things. But, yeah, I first started getting distributed by these sort of... sex, drugs, and rock and roll kind of distributors who did wholesaling to comic book stores and, you know, sort of head shops and, you know, just all kinds of places. Like Last Gasp of San Francisco in San Francisco was one of the places, you know, and they were also sort of a publisher also. They did a lot of the work of R. Crumb and, you know, kind of, I don't know, I want to say this sort of alternative culture kind of stuff. And alternative culture, you know, was just starting to flower at that point from after having been crushed by the mainstream for so long, you know.
That was definitely a time when zines were
zines were thriving. And, you know, we could take out an ad in Fact Sheet 5, which was the big zine thing. Back then you had to send a self-addressed envelope to get the catalog or, you know, a copy of the zines or things. And we put an ad in Fact Sheet 5 and we'd get 500 envelopes in the mail. And, you know, I'd have interns stuffing them with our catalog. And we only had 5 books on sale by that point, you know, that kind of thing. But it was just, yeah, this pre-internet stuff, it was really weird. It was like, we sent a carrier pigeon, and then, you know, someone would shine the bat signal, and then we would distribute leaflets. But, you know, that's what it was like.
So when did you start selling things online, and when after that did you start actually converting to ebook?
Well, so we were the very first publisher in the United States to have a website. Because so my partner Corwin is a tech geek, and so yeah, at the time when, you know, corporations like Toyota and, you know, whatever, we're not on the web yet. Yeah, we were on the web, but even before that, we had an auto send where you could send, if you had email of any kind, you could email to like catalog@circlet.com, and it would email you back the equivalent of sending a SAISY and getting the catalog back. It would email you back a text version, and we used to have, I don't know if you remember, text-only websites. You could use links.
Yep, I totally
to, yeah. So we always had a content-enhanced website that you could read by text only, which now is the equivalent of the mobile-enhanced website that you can read through any phone. You know, we also, yeah, all that kind of thing. But yeah, when it comes to sexual stuff, so many people out there are so repressed, so they expect it to be sort of underground and that they're going to have to work to find it, I think, that no one was surprised by any of these kinds of things. Now it's so easy. It's like, yeah, you can just go on Amazon and click. But within 2 or 3 years, we had gotten regular trade distribution and, you know, started to see our books in Barnes & Noble and Borders and places like that, too. So
there was sort of a tipping point. When I started writing erotica, you wouldn't see erotica in regular bookstores aside from... Mm-hmm. Maybe Henry Miller, Anais Nin. Right. There were a couple
and some anonymous books,
and maybe a few.
Like, I certainly remember when I was a teenager in the mid '90s, and I remember that one of the things I used to do. I had a job that would get out, and I didn't drive, so I had to wait like 2 hours between the time my job would get out and when my mom could come pick me up. and there was a bookstore nearby, and I remember that they had a nightstand, and I would read it covertly at the bookstore. But that was like it. That was the only sexy stuff you could find.
And it was right, we were happening at the same time that a sort of women's literary erotic movement was starting. And so the books like Herotica, and, you know, the Susie Bright books, and you started to see a lot of these upscale trade paperback anthologies that were for women by women. You know, HarperCollins published one called Slow Hand, edited by Michelle Slung, and there were just, like, they had
and
these great...
Yellow Silk was published.
Yellow Silk
the
magazine was then, and, you know, but, yeah, you started to see these things appearing in the bookstores, and what quickly happened was the anthologies section of the bookstore became where all the erotica was starting to get shelved. Then the Best American Erotica series started, which was at Simon & Schuster, you know, whatever. It was these big trade publishers who were doing it. And they were each only doing, you know, one book per season. Mm-hmm. So, but that adds up. So, yeah, the anthologies section became the place to go. And Circlet Press and Cleus Press, another independent press, were publishing a lot
and
in that
Cleus
space.
Cleus is all lesbian?
Cleus was all lesbian, and then the thing was they were doing so well with the erotica anthologies that they branched into gay, and now they've branched into pop culture completely. Cleus is, although they still have a gay and lesbian focus, they publish a lot of sort of just pop culture books that are of all sexualities. So it's sort of interesting the way their transition has gone, you know. So, but yeah, but we were still, we stuck to sort of science fiction was our thing. The whole point was not to kind of take the worst elements of science fiction and the worst elements of pornography and put them together, but to use each as a way of prying open each other's genres. You know, that I felt science fiction had gotten very stale and stagnant, and, you know, it was like, okay, it's great to be heroic, but, you know, where is the full range of human emotion in these books, you know, that kind of a thing. And well, sex is sex. It's going to be the same. The way to make it exciting and interesting and new and different would be to add science fiction or fantastic elements, I thought. So, you know, and here we are 22 years later. That's still what we're doing. So, yeah.
Do you get the sense of having done this that culturally it is more, erotica has become a more accepted literary form?
Oh my God, yes. I used to, like, I mean, people would... I remember I went to a gathering of writers I was living in Philly, so this would have been 1996, and journalists, etc., and they found out I read erotica, and one of them spent an hour haranguing me about how I had to be a nymphomaniac, that was the only explanation for why I would possibly want to write about sex. And just, I mean, really very aggressively.
Wow.
It was the sort of thing that, you know, for 10 years, like, if I mentioned it, it was... like shock silence falling at the dinner table around, mm-hmm. you know, at parties and so on. Like, it was not acceptable at all. And you were seeing sexier and sexier scenes in romance, I think.
Right.
But it was still kind of, it was hidden. It was there, kind of buried in the
but
romance novels.
But now
levels.
It's really, like, up front. Because I started reading romance novels when I was 10 years old, and the ones that had sexy things would have, like, a few sex scenes, and they'd come pretty late in the book.
Late in the book, yeah.
And, like, the ones that I could definitely always read in front of my mother were the Regencies, because they didn't have any sex, or if, like, they did, it was a fade to black.
Right.
And so it was, like, sort of, like, they got married, and then on their wedding night, fade to black, and they were going to be happy.
Right.
But, like... Now I read the historicals, and a lot of the ones set in the Regency have, like, tons of really graphic erotic scenes. And erotic romance is not really a bad word anymore, which it used to be, like, kind of like, that's really not okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've noticed, like, you were talking about Anne Rice and her vampires. Mm-hmm. That was before paranormal romance was a thing. And now, like, paranormal romance and urban fantasy both have lots of graphic vampire sex.
And I think it's not a coincidence that I think the level of eroticism went up first in paranormal before it kind of bled out into the other romance subgenres, because I think because of the kind of work we were doing, and that we're a part of this change in the gestalt, that the way you get people to have more sexual thoughts is you take them out of their repressive context, you know, they take them out of the repressive normal way of thinking, you know, oh, you must be a nymphomaniac if you're writing about sex, because that's somebody who's totally bought into what they've been told all their lives. But it's like, well, like, we're going to set this on another planet where the rules are different, and the politics is different, and gender is different, you know, and that allows people to explore those fantasies without all the baggage that comes with sort of, you know, what our real life, you know, what your parents think about sex, what your preacher thinks about sex, what your politicians think about sex. You know, it's like, oh, I can remove you from all that by saying, and now we are on the time-traveling unicorn planet, you know, whatever, and people will go with it, you know. It's a way of disarming them, so, you
It's
know.
Really funny because right now, one of the books that I've heard a lot of the romance community talking about and getting really excited about is called The Last Hour of Gan. I haven't read it. I
haven't read it either.
But it's apparently, it's set on a lizard planet full of lizard people.
Oh, interesting.
And so, like, the hero of the book is this lizard person, and the heroine is a human female. Mm-hmm. And there's, like, all of this sort of, like, he kind of thinks she's gross because her body is soft and hairy and squishy. And like, the romance community cannot stop talking about this book to the point where I'm like, this really doesn't sound like my kind of book, but I might have to read it anyway.
I admit, I do have lizard man sex in my books.
That's true. There's just
a little bit.
There is a lizard man in The Stars Change, even.
That's true.
You know, so we've got... Yeah.
Well, that's a perfect segue into talking about your book, actually.
It's not the way I usually start off.
But do tell us about The Stars Change, which is now out through Circlet Press, and that's a book that I think you've spent a lot of time working on and knew was going to be something that would be hard to place.
Yeah. It takes a little while to think about, like, which angle to come in with, but so when I came up with the idea, I wanted to do, so there's this memoir that I've been sort of wrestling with for 8 years now, and I'm on my fourth draft, it's given me such headaches, and I was sick of working on it, right? So I wanted something fun. And I was like, I'm going to put this aside, I'm going to do a fun little project, it'll be science fiction, and what happens on the day that the world ends, right? Like, what war is announced, people think the world's going to end, what would you do, right? And I think a lot of people would go to bed, right? And they would find their partner, or they'd go find a stranger, and they'd have one last round of sex before things go up in flames. So I started with that premise, and I thought, okay, I'm going to write an erotica book, and with this science fictional background, and it's set on a South Asian settled university planet a few hundred years from now. There's lots of aliens, there's humans, there's the genetically modified humans. As I was writing, it turned out that the reason for the war was this race war kind of thing, where there was a pure human movement that sort of was against everybody else. And what happens at the start of the book is that a missile has been set off and is... There's a missile attack, and there's a threat of more missiles directed at the Warren, which is sort of the alien ghetto in the university town. So, and then the question is, how are people going to deal with that? So I'm writing this book, and it becomes not nearly as silly as I thought it was going to be. It turned much more serious, which perhaps, if I'd thought about it being a war book, I might have been able to anticipate. It ended up being very much... resonating with everything else I've been writing, which is about Sri Lanka and the Civil War. So I didn't really realize it was all going to make its way into the book until I had finished writing the book. So I wrote it, and I actually did this as part of as a Kickstarter project, because I thought, this is going to be science fiction erotica, it's going to be hard to place, it's a silly little thing. It's very odd, I did not actually think about Circlet Press, which is bizarre in retrospect. I think it was just, I wanted to try Kickstarter, I think was part of it, because I had a couple of friends, Tim Pratt, Toby Bickell, who had both recently done very successful Kickstarters for series books that had gotten canceled partway through a series, right. And they wanted to pick up the series and finish it. So I thought, I was curious as to whether I could make that work. So I kind of ran the numbers, set a goal of 8,000, met the goal. And so that was great. I wrote the book, which took a year longer than I thought it would take. So sorry again to my Kickstarter supporters who waited very patiently. But I wrote the book and revised it and workshopped it and all of that, got it to a happy point, started looking into all the layout and publishing and et cetera things, and I was like, oh, right, I do know how to do this stuff. I've done a bit of it before. It's going to be a lot of work. Hey, I wonder if there's a small press who would be interested in this, and why didn't I think of that earlier? And I started looking around, and you know, I made up a little list of places I might approach, but the top of my list was Circlet. And I loved working with Cecilia before. I was very excited about the chance to work with her again, and so I sent it to her, And thankfully, she liked it. So
thankfully, I was sick in bed the day that you emailed the manuscript, actually.
Yeah.
So you had nothing to do but read.
It was literally like, I had not intended to read it right then. I have other stuff in my reading queue that has been, you know, some of those authors have been waiting extremely patiently for a really long time. But it was one of these, like, that, you know, I was on cold medicine and, you know, whatever, and I just clicked on the attachment, and the next thing you know, I'm reading this book. And
pro writer tip, get your editor on cold medicine.
Right.
So
the next thing you know, I'm reading this book, I'm totally sucked in. The next thing you know, I'm editing the book. And the thing is, it's not a very long book. It's
a novella. It's right under 40,000 words.
Yeah, it's right on that bite-sized. So it was well within my abilities, even on cold medicine, to read the entire thing and do an editing pass, and a copy editing pass, actually. Yes, I can copy edit in cold medicine. And send it back within 24 hours. I was like, yes, I want it. Here's a contract. By the way, here are my editorial notes.
That's not the way it usually goes.
No, it's really not the way it usually goes.
Wow.
But, you know,
good when it does.
Yeah.
That tells you a lot.
It was the fates, right? Kind of stepping in.
And if you can get an editor to idly look at your manuscript and then read the whole thing in one sitting because they're that sucked into it, that's a very good way to get them.
Yeah, and I was that sucked into it, too, was the thing. So otherwise you would have gotten an email that was like, wow, I really like the first chapter. Can you give me a couple of weeks to hopefully make some time to read the rest and, you know, this, that, and the other, and
Well, I think it was also kind of geared to press your buttons in some ways, right? And it's got, you know, people of color, science fiction, and sex.
Right. It's got,
there still is not much of that in the literature.
And
right?
we still exist to publish the things that other people won't do. I mean, if somebody comes to me with, you know, a really, really great novel, but that I think they should be marketing to Tor first, I'm going to tell them that. I'm going to say, after you've been rejected at these other places, come back to me. But I don't think you're going to be. I think you have a good chance of skipping the minor leagues and going, you know. Not that I wouldn't love to publish, you know, every Hugo Award-winning author in the world, but, you know, yeah, it's sort of like we exist to push the envelope a little bit and to do some things that if there's something that makes a mainstream editor uncomfortable, chances are I'm going to want it. You know, so yeah, it's like either it's got more sex than they would usually do, or maybe it's more politically pointed, or maybe it's more whatever, you know, that kind of thing. Or maybe, this really doesn't have the kind of protagonist we're used to seeing. Or where's the thing for a 14-year-old boy to identify with in this book? Sorry, there isn't one. You know, that kind of thing. So,
and
yeah.
I mean, I do think the book is, you know, I haven't read a lot of erotica recently because I was writing erotica all through my 20s. I did it for about 10 years, and I read a lot of erotica then. I kind of burned out a bit. And then, you know, around 30 was when I started getting really interested in the Sri Lankan political stuff and writing more about that. In my previous book, Bodies in Motion, is all Sri Lankan family immigrant stuff with the war in the background. You know, I wasn't sure this book would be a good fit for Circlet because I wasn't sure it was sexy enough, right?
Yeah.
You know, so I would say, you know, like, if you talk about it, it's, I don't know that I would call it an erotica book. I'd say sort of it's a science fiction war novel with an ethnic cultural conflict and a thread of eroticism kind of running through it.
Right. And, but the sex can't be taken out. The story, the sex is an integral part of the story, which to me is always one of the things that I'm looking for, is that you can neither take out the sex nor the science fiction, or the book ceases to exist.
Well, and a lot of it is about connection, right? It's about people trying to connect, and sexuality is a big part of that, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So I heard you read from it yesterday, and you talked a lot about your personal experience and background and sort of how that tied in. Tell us a little bit more about that here, because I'm assuming all the listeners will have no idea. Sean wasn't there to hear you read. So, like, talk a little bit about the Sri Lankan War and your experience with that and how that sort of affected what you wrote in The Stars Change.
So, I left Sri Lanka when I was very young. I was 2 years old when I came to the U.S. in 73. Sri Lanka has two large ethnic groups. There's the majority group, the Sinhalese, and the minority group, the Tamils. I think the Sinhalese are around 70% of the country. There are some little groups as well beyond that, but those are the two main ones. I'm guessing most people have heard of the Tamil Tigers, which is the LTTE, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, is an organization that was created, that came together as they would call themselves freedom fighters, I think. After the British left in 1948, there were elections, a Sinhalese government came into power, they put in various things, like they made Sinhala the official national language, they instituted quotas for the university, so there's a whole set of historical events that happened that led to a generation of young Tamil men feeling very much disenfranchised, like they had no future. And many of them took peaceful political options, and some took to more violent forms of protest. And they were agitating for a separate country. They felt that they were being discriminated against, and they wanted to split Sri Lanka into two countries. So it's sort of with all of that background in mind, and what happened in 1983, there had been incidents before, but in July of 1983, I was actually supposed to go to Sri Lanka to visit my grandparents then. I was 12 or 13, somewhere, I think almost 13 at that point. My dad actually got a telegram a week before I was supposed to get on a plane and travel by myself to Sri Lanka, and it just said, there's trouble coming, don't send her. So he canceled my flight, and I didn't go, and then in the capital city, it's called Black July of 83, massive riots broke out. There were men going door-to-door with voter registration lists with names, and the names would tell you what ethnicity the people were, right? You could tell from the names, killing Tamils. And there are really disparate accounts of how many people died, maybe 3,000, maybe 10,000, depending on who you're talking to. And it was incredibly brutal. I have a friend who was there, and she had gone with her family, and she saw, people, they'd take tires and put them around people's necks and set the tires on fire. Men and women raped and killed in the street and so on, right? So she was very lucky in that her father is Tamil, but her mother is Sinhalese. And so her mother kind of, talked, and her dad kept quiet so that they didn't realize that he was Tamil. And her mother kind of got them all out. So all of this is kind of in the background of my life, and I have various after 83. A lot of my relatives left the country; they fled as refugees, and they went to Canada and Australia and England, and some of them eventually came to America. So this is all what's going on. But one of the things that happened in Black July was that you had these people were all neighbors, right? And so at the same time that you had these thugs kind of roaming the streets and killing people, you had Sinhalese people who were giving shelter to their family neighbors and were hiding them in their houses and all of that. And, yelling at the thugs saying, there's nobody here, leave us alone, right, in Sinhala. So that's sort of the seed of the book in some ways. And I didn't really realize it, until I was, until I was done writing it, really, because what happens is when the aliens are under attack, the humans, some of whom are in some ways kind of anti-genetic modification, not so fond of aliens, etc., have to decide, well, where do I stand on this, right? Even if I'm not so fond of these smelly, weird alien neighbors, I don't want them killed, and I'm willing to risk myself to try and stop that. So, anyway. So,
and this is a Lambda finalist this year.
It is a Lambda finalist.
So congratulations.
Thank
that's
you.
Exciting.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Cecilia, you actually have a pretty good track running with the Lambda finalists from
Circlip. We do. We've never won one yet. Circlip Press is like the Suzanne Lucci, right, of the Lambda Literary Awards. We get a lot of nominations, I think, because we do good, strong, literary, groundbreaking work that the judges recognize. But then when it comes to picking a winner, it's sort of like...
Was your Black Feathers nominated or no?
No,
it should have been.
No, it wasn't.
She's got a beautiful short story collection, very literary, very elegant.
Which HarperCollins published in 1998, but and is now out of print, and it's now available in ebook through Circlip because I got the rights back. But the thing was that the Lambdas don't really have a good place for books that mix sexualities together, and that was a short story collection that had gay, straight, trans, bi, et cetera. And
the Lambdas are very compartmentalized.
Right, and then Black Feathers also did the no-no thing of there were some science fiction stories and some real-world stories,
right,
and people just didn't know how to categorize it. And I'm like, welcome to the story of my life. No one ever knows how to categorize
them. Yeah, I remember a few years ago, there was a Jeff Ryman collection that was in the best science fiction one, and it had a few stories that had queer content, but largely wasn't. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of people debating whether that should be on there, because it was a brilliant story collection. It was Paradise Tales. But, like, at the same time, what counts as a queer book?
And what I like is that the Lammies sort of leave it up to each panel of judges. Mm-hmm. And I've judged for them many times in different categories. I always judge a category that I have no conflict or interest in. So I did lesbian memoir last year, for example, which was fascinating because I got to read all these interesting life stories and whatnot. But yeah, they give you a set of guidelines on, you know, like what we're judging about and what the statement and purpose of the Lambie Literary Awards is. But then each group sort of decides, like, we had to decide, was it, would we accept a book that was a biography of a figure that we knew to be a lesbian, but where lesbian content wasn't really important in the biography, kind of a thing, like someone who was sort of revealed later to be a lesbian, and then it's still kind of soft-shoed in the biography and whatnot. And we said, well, we would read it, we wouldn't turn away, you know, it as an entry into the contest, but its chances of making a finalist are sort of slim, given that obviously we're activists through our books, and that we were more likely to look favorably on something, you know, that was. In fact, we look much more favorably on memoir than on biographies, I think, because it speaks so much more strongly to tell our own stories than, you know. Not that there haven't been some fantastic biographies, but yeah, exactly. So yeah, some really, really interesting conversations came out of that within our jury, just on that one category. So, you know, and we're not privy to what the other juries are saying. It's each jury does it by email among themselves, and then you just send your list of here's who we picked for finalists. So, but kind of cool. I've been part of some really, really good, smart conversations about literature through that process. So,
Well, I actually have a question that's about erotica more generally, because something you'd said earlier that you basically implied there's a difference between pornographic work and erotica. And as an idiot, as somebody who is not currently reading, I've read what I'm assuming is probably more pornographic than erotica, but I don't know the difference. I've read one.
I've written both. So,
okay, so what is the difference?
So I used to write porn for a magazine called Puritan. I don't know if you ever saw this.
Puritan.
It's like a hustler quality kind of magazine, right? Sort of hardcore, lots of glossy photo spreads, etc., right? And I wrote two things for them. I wrote the letters that show up in the front of the... Sean's looking at me like he did not realize that these were written. Sorry, like, so those letters are written by someone who's paid to write them.
Actually all real people, and they never really did believe this would happen to them, but somehow...
Yeah, it was actually... They were very smart about it, too. They'd send me the back issue, and they say, be sure to incorporate something from the previous photo spread into the letter. So it's, you know, it'd be something like, you know, Dear Puritan, I really loved that spread with the two girls on the motorcycle. It reminded me of the time I and my college roommate on the motorcycle. Yeah. You know? So I thought that was really clever. But I also wrote these long stories for them. And one thing is that they had to have a sex scene every 1,000 words.
Right.
So they just told me that kind of as a flat-out guideline. Like, there's a certain amount of sex that our readers expect. Mm-hmm. And that's got to be the bulk of your story.
I used to write for Penthouse. I wrote Penthouse letters, which were shorter. The letters are usually only 1,000 words or less.
Yeah.
Whereas their regular stories were basically... They wanted it under 3,000 words, by which they meant 2,500 words exactly, because that's how many fit in, like, a two-page spread. Yeah. And it essentially had to be almost all sex scene with just enough setup to introduce you to the characters and why they got together, like, you know, whatever it is, secretary and her boss on a business trip, and the hotel mixed up their reservations, and then...
Stay in the same hotel room, and then hijinks.
Right, blah, blah, blah. Hijinks ensue. That's it. And what they want mostly is the hijinks, and then there's maybe a little denouement at the end, which is why they didn't want any science fiction, because they're like, well, you spend too much time, like, explaining what's going on. No world building, no whatever. What they really wanted was two people meet, they have sex. That's the formula story for a porn magazine. The thing is, the quality of the writing in the porn magazine can be just as good as the writing in erotica, and many erotica writers who are writing both. It's just that they had just... As long as your story met these specific conditions, it's sort of... Yeah, it's like, well, if you overused adverbs, who cares? You know, whereas...
And there's some language things, I would say, a mm-hmm. little bit, right, in that, like, Puritan definitely wanted, I think, more of the hard Anglo-Saxon language, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, whereas,
agreed.
Which is not that I would not use some of those words in an erotica story, but I certainly wouldn't feel obliged to,
right.
and
mm-hmm.
it, you know, it would depend on whether... I tend to choose the language based on what I think the character would say.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
if the character is someone who would say down there, fine, I'll use down there, right? If
right.
The, like, if she thinks in euphemisms, that's what
right.
goes in the
or
story,
if they think
right?
in medical terminology, I'll do that. I write a lot of mad scientists now who get to use lots of, you know, like steampunk mad scientists, so I get to use this Victorian language with, you know, whatever to play with their both euphemisms and kind of medical scientific
about
terminology.
On this podcast, so you can feel
we can actually use the words. I know, like, I was like,
yeah,
what am I allowed to say?
But we kind of, like, gave up on not having explicit.
Yeah, after having to bleep out, because Jen, who's on the show sometimes, and after, like, spending, like, an hour and a half bleeping out her F-words during a torture cinema episode, I was like, you know, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
We'll just take the explicit
tag,
no kids will listen to our show, fuck it.
Yeah. Well, so, like, there's an exercise I do sometimes when I'm teaching sex writing, where I, first of all, we'll go around the room, and I'll say, okay, first let's just say all of the sex words that you can think of, and I'm putting them all on the blackboard, okay, so, like, here we're gonna write, you know, breast, tits, cunt, you know, et cetera. Like, and so even just getting them used to saying them out loud is an important first step, right? So like, you get familiar, comfortable with the words, ha ha ha, lots of giggles, fine. But then I have them divide their sheet of paper into three columns, and they have to do sexy, clinical, crude.
Uh-huh.
And then they put assign the words to the different columns.
Mm-hmm.
And then you show the room your page, kind of lift it up and show them, and they're really varied.
Right.
And it helps to kind of drive home that the word that you find sexy, your neighbor may find crude, she might think is silly or too clinical or whatever, right? I think that sometimes there's a fourth column of silly.
Right.
Right.
Uh-huh.
So, and so it's just interesting. It's interesting thinking about that.
I found that my editor, I'm doing a BDSM romance series right now with Hachette, which is, you know, one of the big publishers, big New York publisher, and my editor and I totally differ on which words are okay and which words are too much, and like she hates both the word crotch and groin. Like, she finds she finds both those
it's
words
moist.
She finds both the word crotch and groin to be, like, disgusting somehow.
Really?
You know, and I'm like, okay, well, then how am I supposed to, like, that cuts out all words I can, to me, they're
both neutral words. Cecilia's gesturing at that area.
Yeah, so
really.
It's like, you know, okay, so between the thighs and the belly button, there's this area that I have to describe somehow, you know.
Pelvic region.
Pelvic region?
Vulvar area.
Exactly. And I'm just like, you know, but she'll have marked the manuscript, like, can we change this, whatever. And I'm like, I will have changed it from crotch to groin, and then she won't like that either, you know. And I'll be like, oh, no. Oh, what do I do? You know, yeah, it was quite funny, but, you know, and I go through and I make sure, for example, like our female main character never uses the word cunt, because I think a lot of women still really
can't say that word.
They've been told not to say that word, you know, whatever. And so, but the male main character has no problem saying it, you know, whatever. So we're making sure that every time it's in there, it's only out of his mouth, you know, and that it's never in her interior thoughts or in her, you know, whatever. That kind of a thing. It's like, making sure that
so,
was consistent.
It's okay for him to say it and her to find it sexy, but she doesn't say it.
Right, but she would never say it for herself, or when she's thinking about her own body, like, she uses the word pussy instead of the word cunt and things like that.
Fascinating.
So, you know, because I didn't feel it convincing that...
I totally want to assign all the writers now to go and try writing a sex scene. We were having this panel with Nalo Hopkinson at WisCon several years ago where we were discussing this stuff, and she was like, oh, I could never write a sex scene. And I was like, come on, Nalo, you've been there, right? Come on, Nalo, you can do it, And she's like, no, I could never. And then, like, the following year, she showed up, she's like, I wrote a sex scene!
Yes, exactly.
So,
I go through this a lot, where people send us a manuscript where the story is really good, the idea is really good, it's got, you know, it explores sexuality and so forth, but they have that fade to black urge, you know, or whatever, or they give you just a teeny bit of the sex scene, but they don't really give you enough. And I say, look, this is erotica, and I know there's more in there, you know, like, like, you haven't shown me the complete arc of these characters emotional, you know, maturation if you don't show me their whole sex scene together, you know, that kind of a thing. And I send things back, and writers have to write more. And,
I want to pick up on that, because, you know, one of the people used to ask me a lot, why do you write sex scenes? And one of the things I would say that I think is really true is that there are parts of ourselves that we only let out in bed, mm-hmm. right? And
right.
that mm-hmm. so if your job as a writer is to sort of represent the human experience, right, is to sort of give mm-hmm. people access to that, and you say, well, I'm never going to look at this piece of it, it's you're really shortchanging yourself,
yes.
I think.
Uh-huh.
And especially, I think, for, in some ways, especially for your male characters, because I feel like there are a lot of ways in which male life and male emotional life is so constrained in our society, mm-hmm. and the only time they're allowed to let that out is in bed with their partner, right? Like pillow talk, right? Is
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing. So if you
right.
never go there, then you're just kind of skipping that
right.
piece.
You're missing a whole dimension, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, the way I look at it is, if I could cut the sex scene out of your novel and the novel didn't suffer, then that sex scene didn't belong there, because that meant that the plot ground to a halt, character development ground to a halt, and all they did was have sex during that scene. Mm-hmm.
And
in which
a lot
case,
of times with the newer yeah. romance novels, it feels like that.
Yeah.
It feels like that. And
they
this
put
has
it
said
in,
our readership
right.
expects a sex scene every, mm-hmm. like, 75
right.
pages, so
and it's like,
stop the action and make
right.
them have sex.
And it's like, okay, mm-hmm. fine, but I feel like that's, you know, like when you go for a tasting menu at a fine restaurant, they don't just suddenly stop the meal and be like, and now we're going to have a dance performance, and you're just going to sit there and watch this dance, which is perfectly wonderful, perhaps, but you're like, but that's
so
not
like,
what I'm here for.
Basically,
yeah.
you know? I know you're halfway through the second course, but I'd like you to chew this stick of gum.
Yeah.
right. Or something, you know, where it's like, okay, all right, you know. But and this is the thing, though. Sometimes a sex scene will seem pointless, but it will be redeemed later because you will see how it was they set up for something. It's like, okay, that's fine, you know, but that's often true in a novel. There will be
yeah.
an action scene, maybe, or conversation where you're like, was that conversation really important? Well, I guess it was because I trust this author, but
mm-hmm.
but sometimes they really can come out, and you can say, okay, that sex scene was a set piece that you may now put on your website as a reward for your, you know, your readers who write reviews of you for you on Amazon or something,
yeah.
you know,
it's a fine bonus piece.
You know, so
yes.
it goes both ways, but yeah, more often I am encouraging people to put more in.
Yeah, there's more sex in The Stars Change because of you,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, like the book was pretty complete when I gave it to
yeah.
Cecilia,
mm-hmm.
and I'd say that there's, you know, there were sort of minor edits throughout, and then there are two things that she pushed me on, and one was sort of a central climactic kind of argument discussion
mm-hmm.
thing that really was
right.
like the heart of the book,
mm-hmm.
and somehow I kind of, it was going to be hard to write, so I kind of skimmed over it,
yeah.
and she made me go back and write it, and it was like that. And the other thing was the sex scene at the end of the book, which
mm-hmm.
I had sort of, a lot of the sex had sort of dropped out by the end, what with
mm-hmm.
the war and the killing and the death and
mm-hmm.
all of that, right? So, but at the end, you have the sort of denouement, and there's this kind of like, there was a good place to bring the eroticism back in, and the
mm-hmm.
sort of like there is life, right?
Right.
It's not just
mm-hmm.
all about
right.
explosions.
Right.
So,
and I felt it really did need to come all the way back around.
Yeah, no, I think that was a really good
point. You kind of hinted that's where it was going. You're just like, no, you just got to go there.
Yeah. I hinted, like, I think I had a kiss or something. And she said, give us a little more.
Exactly.
So, I want to completely go off of this topic a little bit and talk about your work with Jaggery, which is
mm-hmm.
the Desi Lit Mag that you started. So tell us about your involvement with that.
Sure. So I run this organization, Desi Lit. It's to support South Asian and diaspora literature. We do a lot of different things. Like, we are starting right now planning the Kriti Festival, which is a 4-day literary festival in Chicago. It's going to happen at the end of September. I'm crossing all of my fingers and toes that we can get Mosi and Hamid to be our guest of honor. So, because he's awesome. So, he wrote Moth Smoke, which was beautiful. The Reluctant Fundamentalist, which is going to be made into a film. His new book is How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. And I heard him read from it. It's very funny. In a sardonic kind of way, right? But in any case, Desi Lit, yes. We had a magazine before, actually, that was just called Desi Lit Magazine. And then it went on hiatus for a while, and I decided to reboot it. And I'm editor-in-chief of it now, and what we're really trying to do is promote transnational dialogue.
Mm.
So a lot of sort of ethnic magazines are often basically American magazines, right? And what I'm particularly interested in is this question of, look, here I am, born in Sri Lanka, but grew up here, right? And I wrote this book, Bodies in Motion, was possibly the first Sri Lankan-American book published in America. And I think it was. And as a result, like, I become representative, right? Mm-hmm. So to Americans, yeah. I become representative of Sri Lankan fiction. And that's kind of a weird place for me to be in, given that I've been here since I was 3 years old.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right? And so, and I've always kind of tried to promote Sri Lankan authors and so on, but I try to read stuff from the homeland, and I feel like there's a dialogue that if it happens, will make for better fiction. It'll mm-hmm. make for better literature, where people from the diaspora and people from the homelands are reading each other's work mm-hmm. and are in conversation with each other. And maybe we can get past some of the stereotypes we might have, some of the assumptions we might have, get to a better understanding of each other. Some of us go back and forth. I mean, I travel back to Sri Lanka when I can, but even if you don't. And it's sort of politically urgent in some ways with Sri Lanka, because one of the things that happened with the war is there was this big Tamil diaspora, all these people fleeing, who have now, you know, that was 83, we're now in 2013, so it's 30 years later. Those people settled in Canada and Australia and America, got married, maybe they were married already, they had kids. If they were older, some of their kids are now married and having kids. They're big populations. Toronto has a huge population of Sri Lankans, right? And they still care about the homeland. They mm-hmm. are not just Canadians, right? Right. And so they care about the politics, and there's a back and forth, and the Sri Lankans in Sri Lanka, especially the Sinhalese government, are sort of like, you diaspora people, go off, you left, you abandoned us, leave us alone, right? And that's not going to happen because the diaspora had relatives who died in the war. And mm-hmm. so it's not just a Sri Lankan issue, obviously. I think this is one of the large issues of our time, right? It's one of the large mm-hmm. political issues, whether you're talking about Palestine and Israel or Ireland mm-hmm. or, you know, Serbia, Croatia. I mean, this is just one mm-hmm. of the big political issues. Yep. And so, they brought me to Toronto for this event on reconciliation, where they were bringing writers in to talk about reconciliation and the peace process and so on. And there's this kind of question of, like, how do we get there? And it seems like the first step is that we just have to talk a lot, yeah. you know? We have to talk a lot, write a lot, read a lot. So much is still hidden. So much is unclear. And we're carrying around all these feelings, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know. I hope that literature can help process some of that. I don't know. Sorry, I gave you a long answer to that.
So, like, I want to get a little bit deeper into it. So you say you want this to be transnational. You want to foster the dialogue. So are you looking and accepting stories from...
Yeah, so we're publishing, I think, I won't say half, but a goodly number of the pieces we published have been from the homeland.
Okay.
So, yeah. I mean, we have a little bit of an advantage... an odd advantage with that with South Asia, which is that because we were colonized by the British, English is mm-hmm. big there, right? So, like, you know, all of the upper middle class, upper class speak English, and a lot of them write in English, right? So it's...
Right, you don't have to...
A lot of them have very good... So we don't have to get things in translation. I was just... Yesterday
we
I was
just
at...
Actually, we were at the presentation that Suparna Banerjee did mm-hmm. on Ian McDonald's India, and he was mm-hmm. talking about how in... I think... Where did he say he was from, Sean? I've totally forgotten.
Bengali?
Bengal.
He said Bengal.
He's from Bengal. And he said there that everyone speaks, who is educated to a certain level, will speak English professionally for work, but at home will speak other languages. Right. And the other languages are very disparate, like lots of other languages. And that whenever he goes back there, they will ask him, in America, like, what language do they speak? And he says, English. And then they say, well, what language do they speak at home? And he says, well, English.
and the
answer is sort of perplexing and baffling to them. But the interesting thing about that is that I think, as you were saying, South Asian countries have a lot of potential for people writing in English.
I mean, I would love to do translations as well. It's just expensive and difficult. But, I mean, like, we have some sort of tentative plans for poetry, to do single language issues for the poetry, and we'll say, like, we're going to do Hindi, Right, and then we'll present the poetry in Hindi and with an English translation.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah, I think that will be great. So it's going to be more work to set up, but I think it'll be really excellent. So, and I think for poetry we can hopefully find volunteer translators because our budget is so small right now. So,
so when you say you read a lot of work from the home country, are you reading in English? Or are you reading?
Yeah, no, I'm reading in English. I understand Tamil, but I don't read it.
Okay.
So. I wish I did. My parents, like many immigrants, came here and it was immediately English, uh-huh. right?
Yeah.
So let us assimilate as fast as possible. Where's your family from?
My father's from the Philippines,
yeah.
And but the family's from China.
Right.
So they moved to the Philippines and didn't teach them Chinese, and then moved to America and didn't teach us any of the Filipino languages.
Yeah,
so,
my father came from Mexico and came over here when he was 15, so I was born here, and he... totally thought all of his children should speak English.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of assimilation. You want to assimilate. Yeah. You want to make sure that your child has the best advantages.
Safer, right? I mean, depending on,
which has come up like every single interview that we've done because we keep talking to people with different backgrounds.
Because you're the only one on this show that has an interesting background. Mine is like, hey, I'm descended from old dead white guys from England.
It is, and I'm going to call that out a little bit, right? Because this is one of the things I get into with my students sometimes, is that they're like, well, you know, I say, don't make your characters generic white, and they're like, but we're white, and I'm like, but you're not generic white, right?
You have
a specific historical background, right? Your parents came from somewhere, your grandparents came from somewhere. It is different to be the fourth generation son of a German, right, than of a Pole, for a really obvious example,
even if
right?
you don't know the immigration background of your family, you know your personal history.
Right.
So, do you say pop or Coke?
Yeah.
Soda? I say soda.
You say soda. Well, so that's an ethnic...
Coke is a specific brand.
Atlanta
Coke is every flavor.
That's part of your ethnic heritage right there. You're a certain kind of white American.
Right.
Well, it's true.
This is the thing, when you take it into the context of science fiction, people are like, well, I'm going to set this on another planet, and I'm just going to... But it's like, you have to... I try to teach people, you have to explore more about the backgrounds of your characters than not less. You don't just get to say, okay, it's the Starship Enterprise, and there's one of every color person there, but they all came from Earth, and so the more important thing is just they're Earthers, you know, whatever. Yeah. It's like, no, okay.
How did we get here?
You have to put some...
Earthers. For some reason, when you're in space, you're all Terrans.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's an attempt, I think, in some science fiction to sort of gloss over that idea that somehow we all united, and it's like, mm-hmm. well... How did we get to this point?
Right.
And how did they figure... Because, like,
well,
we can't...
We intermarry. We have little beige babies, like my children.
Yeah.
Right?
But those aren't ever the characters in, like, Star Trek. Like,
four generations down, like, everyone's intermarried, so everyone's beige. People have told me this. Like, that's the plan.
I remember in high school, one of my teachers presenting this as, like, a thing that was going to happen in the future to my class.
There was a cover of Time Magazine.
You guys... You know, right now, you think that everything is divided into race, but by the time you're adults, your children are all going to look exactly alike. And I was like,
well, this is the kind of funny thing, is that for a while people really thought this, and there was a cover of Time Magazine where they were like, we've had a computer-generated face of what happens when you have the mixed genetics, you know, so on, they all look exactly like me. Mm. I'm Chinese, Filipino, Irish, Welsh, okay? Mm. And it was funny. And the thing is, when I grew up, we were not drowning in half-Asians. And we could pick each other out from a mile away.
Mm-hmm.
A Hapa can recognize a Hapa from a mile away.
It's really interesting. I live in Oak Park now, which is a suburb of Chicago and has a lot of mixed-race children. And specifically, there are enough mixes of South Asian with white, they all look like my kids. I mean, it is freaky. Yeah. I can wander around Oak Park and I'll be like, I know what your parents are going to look like because you look like my kids. And yes, the parents show up and one is South Asian and one is white.
You just don't know which one is going to be.
Yeah, you don't know which one it will be, but you know what the...
Exactly. So, it's interesting. But
it is interesting, and it is something that I think is probably going to happen. It's just not going to be like Star Trek.
But I don't know. I mean, it doesn't have to be blending, right? Because you can go with the other Star Trek options, right?
The infinite
diversity.
I think there definitely will be more
people who look like blends of other people, but there also still will be people mm-hmm. who don't look like blends of other people. You're still going to have the pale-skinned redhead, for right. instance. Yeah. Like, that's, I don't think that's actually going extinct, which is one of the things right. that people get really yeah, worried no, about, like, not. Save our redheads.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, no. But there's like
genetics turns out to yeah. be much more complicated than what yeah. we're taught in high school genetics, too, well, and then a lot of it is like, you know, well, yeah. two black cats have kittens, and the kittens come out with orange stripes.
Yeah,
you and know. There's an attraction to difference, and there's too. Also an attraction exactly. to like, right? To people yeah, who come right. from your background and your mm-hmm, community sure. and share your religion, and all of those are reinforcers. They share your language, right. etc. Sure, right? Sure. So not everyone yes. goes for the strange.
It's not really the it's not really the melting pot. It is the mixing pot. Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or the mosaic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
It is a mosaic. I didn't realize I'm wearing a giant metaphor.
So to bring it back to Jaggery and reading Sri Lankan mm-hmm. stories, have you read much of the fantastic or science fiction from there? Is there much?
There is more and more, mm-hmm. I think. So, I mean, you know, it was funny. I was talking to Usman Malik yesterday. He's a New Clarion grad. He just graduated last summer, and he's Pakistani-American. And he said to me, like, are you the first South Asian in science fiction? And I had to, like, stop and think. And I'm like, I might be the first South Asian American in science fiction, right? Like, I'm, like, thinking back to early conventions because there was me, and then Vandana Singh came right. a few years later, right. Anil Menon. Yeah. There are a few more, and there are more and more coming.
I think there are other ones that I know who are younger, though.
That's what I mean. So, like, so there's, yeah. I think now it's starting to really break out. And, of course, there are a lot of people in the homeland writing mm-hmm. science fiction and have right. been for a long time, but it hasn't made it over here yet.
Right.
Right. So there's, mm-hmm. so it'll be interesting to see what happens. I think it's going to be, I think we're on the cusp of a revolution. So. Mm-hmm.
Like some, we need some anthologies.
Well, yeah, so funny you say that. Because Cecilia awesome. And I and some other people have been talking about it for a while. Yes. I'm not quite sure how it's going to play out.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, there is Dark Matter, which does, Black Science Fiction, which is an excellent anthology, also Dark Matter 2. There are a bunch of them. There's Cosmos Latinos, which is Latin American mm-hmm. science fiction, Wandering Stars, which is Jewish science fiction. There's So Long Been Dreaming, post-colonial science yep. fiction, the Apex Book of World Science Fiction 1 and 2, The Dragon and the Stars, which is Chinese-American
really?
Science fiction.
I haven't
fiction.
Even seen that one.
So. Yes. Yeah. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. I would like to talk right. to you about it at some point. You should read it.
Mm-hmm. Charles Tan did some of the Filipino
stuff. Yeah. Right? Yeah. And so. There's Three Messages and a Warning, mm-hmm. which is Mexican science fiction. Right. So,
and two Apex yeah. books yeah. of World SF, and the third one coming.
Right. Oh, is there one coming?
I think
one
it's
coming?
Next year, maybe.
Yeah, so, right. I mean, we have been mm-hmm. talking for over a decade about wanting to, Cecilia and I, about mm-hmm. wanting to put together an Asian...
Right, probably pan-Asian
book. It gets complicated. Like, do you do... just pan-Asian American?
Right.
Is it just the diaspora, which is already huge,
right?
Right, as a topic. Mm-hmm. And if you try and bring in the homeland too, I don't know, it ends up feeling just way too
right.
big.
Like the anthology that I'm currently co-editing, I think we've almost accepted everything, or sort of like can't announce the final table of contents quite yet because we haven't contracted everything.
Right. Yeah.
But we ran into the problem of basically, when we started putting this together, we decided that we were looking for diverse YA science fiction and fantasy, and then the question was, what does diverse mean?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And Elisa, who is my co-editor, was like, this will be pretty easy. And I was like, no, it won't. And then as the process went on, and we started to like see what submissions we got, and what balance mm-hmm. we had, and what we were looking for, and what would balance each other out, we're like, okay, wait, if we accept this, are we accepting too many of this kind mm-hmm. of story?
Right.
Is the book then suddenly right. going to be like this kind of book?
I would say, like, my ideal version of this anthology would actually be four books. It would be mm-hmm. South Asian, East Asian, possibly even Southeast Asian. Okay, mm-hmm. so that's right. that is now three books.
Right.
And
half
then
the world,
and then the other three would be the diaspora. So
right.
like you'd have the homeland books and the diaspora books, and then you could read them together. And
ooh,
that would be
right.
awesome, but I need a publisher willing to
right,
let
to
us edit six
books.
Books.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, but that would be the right way to do it in some sense. Right. But you know, it can also be that can be the second iteration, right? Like
right.
we can first do
like
at least one
yeah,
book.
One
then,
foundational thing that can then
yeah.
have more things.
Like an introduction.
Yes,
and then,
an introduction.
And then
here's some highlights, and then we'll
yeah.
do mm-hmm. a more comprehensive version when the market's ready for it.
Right.
So are there specific themes or things that you've seen come up in fiction coming from the home country?
So I teach Asian American... I mean, I teach writers of color in science fiction and fantasy. And one... This is just one tiny thing I've noticed so far, is that I'm seeing this in Ted Chiang's work, in, I'm going to blank on her name, she published a story in Strange Horizons about these vampires and schoolgirls, like high school girls. I'm sorry, I can't remember right now, but she, and a couple others that seem very concerned with appearance and beauty. Specifically, right? Which is different from, like, if you're reading dark matter, there's a lot of color, there are a lot of stories about skin tone, about lightness and darkness, and the Asian stuff, the, especially the East Asian specifically, seems more of a beauty culture, and questions of, like, how do you define beauty? And if you think about that in terms of, like, the big boom of plastic surgery, it seems, and, like, I was just at a lecture that someone was talking about, like, the rise of, like, video bloggers that give Asian beauty tips to Americans is apparently a huge thing with millions of viewers. And so I feel like that's got to be one thread in the literature. So
that's just
that's fascinating.
We have 3 minutes before
I think we're pretty much out of time. So let's actually find out where we can find your work and you online and elsewhere.
So, to start thesis,
you can find Circlet Press at circlet.com, and all of our books and ebooks are available in all your usual bookselling outlets, including your local independent bookstore. They can always order us from a major book distributor. So support your local independents, please.
Though I guess if you're too embarrassed to go into a bookstore and buy erotica,
you can always download.
One of the great blessings of online. Yes, I'd say I have a couple books that have come out recently. The Stars Change, of course. Also, I've re-released my first book, Torn Shapes of Desire, as an ebook, and audiobooks of both of those, and Silence in the Word, which is my second collection. So they're all available online. To find me, if you Google Marianne, I'm on the first page, so I'm really easy to find. I've been on the internet a long, long time, and with age comes privileges, I guess. And I'm also incredibly prolific on Facebook. So please feel free to friend me. I friend indiscriminately.
But if you friend her, you should be prepared that she posts a lot about cooking delicious things.
I do post a lot about cooking things. I also post a lot about social justice issues and race. And and what else? Adjunct politics and so on.
Exactly.
So,
but it,
also funny things. It's not all serious.
So. No, it's a good variety of stuff. But it does make me hungry. If I have to be careful.
Say, if you follow my Twitter or my Instagram, which is Cecilia Tan, I post a lot of delicious foods. I'm either cooking, eating, or have gone out to eat.
Yes, I would say you asked about threads in the literature. Food is a big thread in Asian American literature. So, like, huge. So.
Well, awesome, guys. Well, thank you, Marianne, for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, have a great
time.
Thank you. It was fun. Yeah, awesome. Thanks a lot.
Awesome. And on that note, awkward ending. And scene.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.
Hey everybody, welcome to the World SF Tour, our special feature throughout the year in which we're obviously celebrating World SF. There are a number of ways you could support this show, just really quick. One is you could subscribe to the show. We're on iTunes, we have the blog, all that good stuff. There's all kinds of cool stuff on the blog too you should check out. That's one way you could support us. You can obviously let people know about us. That's really cool when people do that, link to us and all that good stuff. And the other way is actually to go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for 1 month free trial membership. You get a free audiobook out of the deal. You get to try their service if you like it, to keep it, which is cool. And yeah, I mean, that's really that simple. So that helps us as much as the rest of it does. But in any case, thank you for listening. I really hope you enjoy this year, this very specially themed year. And, of course, if we missed anything, which we're undoubtedly going to do, feel free to let us know. Send us an email or leave a comment or something. Maybe even on some of our discussion episodes, you let us know about some great works from a certain region that we should be talking about. So, in any case, I'll let you get to the episode, and I hope you enjoy it.